Welcome to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we will be talking, of course, about the new attack by the Department of Justice on Inauguration Day protesters. In that case, it's ongoing there, as well as the new documentary film, Whose Streets? But before we can move on, Donald Trump's fascist-defending press conference yesterday has injected even greater urgency into moves to take down Confederate monuments all over the country. Already in the wake of the murder of Heather Heyer by a white-powered terrorist, many localities moved to either take down the statues or accelerate previous plans to remove the statues. Most notably, in Durham, North Carolina, protesters actually pulled one down themselves in what was a triumphant and joyous rally against white supremacy and hatred. Authorities in Durham have now arrested three people for this righteous act. Takiyah Thompson has been charged with two felonies and two misdemeanors, including the totally absurd felony riot charges for bringing down the statue. And now Dante Strabino and Lone Tran, fellow organizers, have also been arrested and hit with the same charges. All three are members of the socialist organization Workers' World Party. So needless to say, these charges are totally bogus and should be dropped. These courageous activists only did what localities are doing all around the country and what millions know is unequivocally the right thing to do. Process be damned. Those interested in supporting these organizers can and should contact the Durham Solidarity Center to find out more. Baltimore, allegedly after the mayor got wind some Confederate statues might find their way down on their own, if you will, moved quickly last night after the city council voted to remove the statues, deploying crews of construction workers protected by police officers, like in New Orleans, to take the statues down. By 5:30 a.m., giant statues of Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson were headed out of the Charmed City on flatbed trucks. Following on the actions in Baltimore, Maryland Governor Larry Hogan has called for the statue of Roger Taney, former Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, to be removed from the state capitol grounds in Annapolis. Taney's name is one of the most infamous in the annals of America because of the decision he authored in the Dred Scott case. The 1857 decision confirmed the supremacy of slavery in the country, and it is most known for Taney's blistering words in the final decision that blacks had, quote, no rights the white man was bound to respect. End quote. The decision also reaffirmed the belief of slaveholders that blacks were inferior, almost subhuman beings. In Gainesville, Florida, right after the tragic events in Charlottesville, the city moved to get rid of the Confederate soldier statue known as Old Joe. On Monday, the Republican governor of Tennessee, Bill Haslam, asked state officials to remove a bust of Nathan Bedford Forrest, a Confederate officer and founder of the Ku Klux Klan, from the state capitol after activists drew attention to this shameful reality. A cemetery in Hollywood in L.A. found a monument to Confederate soldiers and will be removing that as well. Clearly, the momentum is against these monuments, even in areas where support for the Confederate cause runs high. This is certainly a welcome development. And the fallout continues for the Trump administration more directly in the wake of Trump's exchange with reporters yesterday about his response to fascists. Trump's initial hesitance to denounce white supremacy had led to high-level defections to his high-level CEO advisory councils, including Ken Frazier, CEO of Merck, and one of the more prominent African-Americans publicly willing to collaborate with Trump. Kevin Plank of Under Armour also jumped ship right after Frazier, along with Intel CEO Brian Krasnick. The head of the Alliance for American Manufacturing also out, as is Richard Trumka, the head of the AFL-CIO. This morning, Wall Street titan Stephen Schwarzman of BlackRock held a call with a number of top CEOs left in the game here, and unsurprisingly, they decided to abandon the ship altogether. And the sort of leaks from that meeting had the status of the council in doubt all morning. And at about 1 p.m. today, President Trump tweeted out that he was, in fact, disbanding both councils because of the pressure on CEOs. This is actually a pretty big blow to the Trump administration. These councils are basically symbolic, but they were key signs that the Trump regime may actually be able to govern when they were set up initially. Having campaigned as a disruptive outsider, many were unsure what sort of tact Trump would take towards the capitalist elites. He seems that initially he wanted to placate them, and he established these councils as a sign of how he was assembling a team of top corporate execs to fix the country. And no wonder pressure is mounting on these folks and the president himself when his supposedly off-script comments have been so warmly and interpreted and received by fascists. David Duke took to Twitter and stated, quote, "Thank you, President Trump, for your honesty and courage to tell the truth about Charlottesville and condemn leftist terrorists," end quote. Nazi Richard Spencer called Trump's comments, quote, "fair" and, quote, "down to earth," later saying, "absurdly, we came in peace." Breitbart called Trump's address a smackdown to the press. Not exactly sure how saying Nazis are very fine people and that celebrating slave owners is good is a smackdown to the press rather than his own reelection chances, but okay. Just about every senator of any note on both sides has criticized Trump on this, and many Republicans are at pains to distance themselves from him. At this point, Trump's embrace of fascists seems far more toxic than any charge leveled at him so far. He's more isolated and embattled than ever, and the real question becomes, when does his staff start resigning too? And in other horrible news today, unfortunately, new information from the Centers for Disease Control show overdose deaths of those between 15 and 19, so teenagers, starting to increase again and steadily increasing since 1999, and yet another example of, among other things, how the opioid epidemic ravaging the country needs to be addressed decisively. While dipping a bit in the past couple years, the rate of overdoses in this age category has more than doubled since 1999. For males, the rate nearly tripled. Roughly 80% of these overdoses were unintentional, while 13% were suicides. Looking purely at opioid overdoses, the rate has tripled since 1999. Clearly, there are serious issues in this country with drug abuse and addiction. It's important that this fact and attempts to address it not be overshadowed. And those are today's talking points, and you are listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us.
By any means necessary.
And we are very happy to be joined as we continue our conversation here with Sam Menifee-Leiby. Sam, thank you so much for being willing to join the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
So I know you've been working very diligently around the issue of the defense of those who were arrested at the counter-inaugural protest on January 20th. Big break in that case. Well, I don't know break, but big news in that case this week in terms of the government seeking millions of people's online records. Talk to us about what exactly is going on.
So, as you mentioned, I've been working on providing support to the over 200 people who were kettled, mass arrested, and charged with felonies as a result of protesting Donald Trump on Inauguration Day, working with a strong collective of folks in D.C., the Dead City Legal Posse. We've been working on the case, I guess, since the indictments came down. So since January 21st, where a group of folks who came together in response to all this. And yesterday, or I guess on Monday, DreamHost, which is the organization that was hosting the website, disruptj20.org, was the website for the organization that helped to coordinate all of the sort of mass direct actions against Donald Trump on the Inauguration Day that were so successful. So DreamHost was served with a subpoena by the U.S. Attorney's Office as a part of the ongoing prosecution against the folks who were kettled and mass arrested on Inauguration Day. As a part of the subpoena, they asked for IP address information, which would sort of provide geographical locations for everyone who visited the site disruptj20.org, which, according to DreamHost, is over 1.3 million people. The disruptj20.org was sort of a clearinghouse put together by local D.C. organizers for anti-inaugural protests and direct actions that had some really remarkable success. On January 20th, there were blockades, against checkpoints. If you look at the overhead photograph of the crowd that Donald Trump was so proud of at the Inauguration Day, you'll notice that the north half of the mall is notably emptier than the south half of the mall. And that is because over 2,400 people risked arrest and put their bodies on the line to engage in direct action, shutting down the checkpoints, preventing people from getting in to celebrate the fascist Donald Trump as he was inaugurated on January 20th. There were also a number of other things that were coordinated under the banner of Disrupt J20. There was a festival of resistance. There were sort of all-day activities, including sort of kid-friendly activities at McPherson Square downtown, which over 5,000 people participated in. And then there was also the anti-capitalist march, which was what the police responded to with such brutality and in such stark contrast to the way that they sort of handled the fascists with kid gloves in Charlottesville this past weekend. So this subpoena is part of that sort of ongoing case, and it's something that we're surprised to see such broad interest in, considering that, you know, we've been having a hard time getting folks to pay attention to this prosecution over the past several months. But, you know, we welcome any and all support that folks are interested in providing, and we're glad that, you know, outlets like The Hill are starting to cover this case with the importance that it deserves.
And, you know, it's one of the things that I think is certainly jaw dropped when I saw this, but I mean, sort of the asking for this 1.3 million records, it in some ways reminds me or seems similar to me with just the idea of even arresting the 200 people, dropping these serious charges, that to some degree, the prosecution of these defendants is designed to have a chilling effect on First Amendment activity. I can't even imagine, like, what could have a more chilling effect than what seems to be like this, is that they want to even make a database of anyone who even thought about protesting Donald Trump. They would have that information for just about every person who might think that was relevant, a relevant place to be on January 20th. I mean, it seems extraordinary, but a piece with kind of the way this whole prosecution has been carried out from beginning to end.
Right. I mean, you are no stranger to the nefarious functions of the criminal injustice system in the United States. You know, this is all sort of part of how this works, right? It seems, you know, not totally unlikely that this may get sorted out in the next 5 years, right, and create some sort of precedent. But the fact is that this will have a chilling effect on people who are resisting right now in the time of incredible urgency. I mean, Nazis murdered people this weekend. They attacked a crowd of people intending to cause as much harm on folks as possible who are engaged in anti-fascist protests. And it's time to take action. We need people in the streets. And what we have here is the Department of Justice led by, you know, Jefferson Beauregard Sessions, you know, trying to create a database of dissenters. It is truly Orwellian. It's horrifying. And, you know, that this is also part of the sort of ongoing, I mean, as you mentioned in your question, this is part of of what's at stake in these cases against these folks who were kettled and mass arrested on Inauguration Day as well. That, you know, one of the sort of legal doctrines for First Amendment jurisprudence is the notion of prior restraint, right? That basically, like, there can't be any action taken by the government that causes a chilling effect on First Amendment activity. And that's something that has been, you know, part of the arguments on the motions to dismiss these cases by defense attorneys. And here I think that, you know, we have something that definitely indicates that the government is willing to punish folks for just inquiring into a dissenting activity, not to mention actually engaging in dissenting activity that is supposedly, you know, according to the sort of lore of America, as American as apple pie. And, you know, we're, as always, if you pay attention to this stuff, as you and I do, you know that that lore is false, and then that's a sort of legitimating force for the mass brutality of the prison system, of policing, of the laws that wind up sort of scrutinizing people in the extreme. And, you know, this definitely echoes the programs that were brought to light by, the courageous leaks of Edward Snowden. And, you know, I'm sure that that some agencies in the federal government somewhere already have this information. But this is an attempt to get the sort of private corporations that have control over this information to provide it willingly to the U.S. Attorney's Office, using incredibly broad justifications.
You know, one thing I'm curious about it, I mean, obviously there's, I mean, in some ways no way to probably know this exactly, since I know you're not inside of people's minds, but it does seem to me that, you know, sort of what we saw, and I think you mentioned this, sort of the situation in Charlottesville, the way the police acted there, the targeting of activists of January 20th, that there is a different sort of standard that the authorities try to use when the leadership and a lot of the people who are involved in things may be more radical radical in terms of their political orientation, radical, that is, wanting to go to the root of all of these problems and address them directly, then, you know, perhaps that we see with some more things. I mean, it almost seems like they're also trying to create sort of the loyal opposition narrative as well. About a minute to our first break, but start, and we can come back on this point, please.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you're right that we can't really get inside people's heads, especially, you know, considering that, you know, police forces and prosecutors and, you know, folks come from a wide variety of backgrounds with a wide variety of you know, motivations and sort of records, right? But we can state pretty, you know, with a strong sense of certainty that anti-fascist protests, anti-racist protests, are met with a different level of police response than protests from fascists, from armed fascists, from people carrying Nazi regalia, from, you know, folks who came armed to the teeth, preparing to engage in open violence. And that, you know, we saw that in Berkeley, and we saw that again this weekend in Charlottesville. And the police, you know, it do, in fact, engage those people differently than people coming from the left to engage in unarmed, you know, resistance to racism and fascism.
Absolutely. Well, we're going to take a break quick on that point. We're going to come back with more on this issue on By Any Means Necessary here on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm Eugene Perrier. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are talking about some of the continued news out of the attempted prosecution, I would say repression of protests resulting from the criminalization of protests at the inauguration on January 20th. And we continue to be joined by Sam Menifee-Libby, who's been working on that issue. And, you know, Sam, one thing that I think is very relevant with this, and I felt this way, and I honestly felt that this was and you referenced that it was difficult to get people to pay attention to the story. I think that what I'm about to bring up is a huge piece of this. I think we're seeing this again, obviously, after Charlottesville. We saw the president say it. And that's this issue of moral equivalence between these far-right fascist forces and the anti-fascist forces, which is obviously a very, I think, diverse group of people who would consider themselves anti-fascist, this kind of moral equivalence that put between the two, the blame on both sides, the both are instigating this. And, I mean, as you might imagine, I find that whole thing absurd. But it does seem like this device is continually trotted out in these moments to try to, and relevant to my last question, to try to sort of cordon off or police, you know, what, you know, behavior, acceptable or unacceptable behavior, which I find interesting because then when it's about fascist free speech, then it's like, well, we shouldn't care at all who these people are or what they did. They should be able to do what they do. It's just an interesting paradox, I think, societally. Your thoughts?
Yeah, it is a total paradox. It's also, you know, the notion that fascism is protected by free speech is, you know, not only morally repugnant, but it actually goes against the very notions of the First Amendment, sort of established jurisprudence of, you know, how the First Amendment works. If people are inciting to violence, that's not protected by the First Amendment, right? And fascism and Nazism is about incitement to violence. It's about incitement to genocide. It is about incitement to lynching. It is about incitement to police shootings of, you know, young people of color. It is about, you know, just a politics of a repression, a politics of domination, a politics of oppression. And, you know, no matter how it's rebranded, no matter how many folks insist that white nationalism is different than white supremacy, it is all based on the same sort of oppression and repression of people of color, of people on the left, of working people, and that we need to stand up to it unequivocally and also call it out for what it is, that it is a politics that is inciting to violence, and it is not just speech. It's not just someone, you know, it's not a matter of the words coming out of someone's mouth. It's a matter of the overall political program that they're engaged in, the political activity that they are advocating and fighting for. And, you know, we really have seen this very strange development on the right, including from President Trump, that, you know, they think that they can sort of create these equivalencies between, you know, Black Lives Matter and fascists and Nazis in ways that are stunning and in ways that no person observing the situation in good faith, no people engaged in sort of steady and sustained observation of the situation would ever remotely legitimate, right? So, I mean, we saw something from the Southern Poverty Law Center yesterday saying that, you know, they had to reiterate Black Lives Matter is not a hate group. Just, you know, wild to me that's where we're at now, is that, you know, you have all this dissembling and all of this sort of rhetorical dishonesty coming from the right, coming from the Republican Party, in, you know, at the national level, at the state level, at the local level, and it's and it has to be repudiated by, you know, folks who professionally watch Nazis and call out racism and extremism. I mean, this also, you know, goes back to the fact that this is part of an ongoing struggle, right? That Charlottesville had a lot of people paying attention who weren't paying attention before, but, you know, there are 196 people facing over 8 felony charges in D.C. from an anti-fascist protest on Inauguration Day. There have been anti-fascist struggles here for years, for decades, for as long as America has been around, for as long as settler colonialism has been a thing, there have been struggles against racist hatred and fascism and repression. And, you know, Charlottesville is one the battle in that ongoing war against white supremacy. And, you know, we've seen a noted escalation, especially over the past 18 months, from supposedly mainstream political actors in this war. And that we've seen things from police departments and from, you know, Republican lawmakers advocating running over protesters with cars. And that's, you know, that's incitement to violence. They, you know, are... They may step back and say that they were being ironic or that this is protected speech or whatever. But the fact is that they are advocating for the murder of folks who are standing up to white supremacy.
Yeah, you know, I think that's a very good point. And I think in terms of also how we sort of view the issue of the protesters who are facing these charges is, I mean, to me, it seems like there's a fairly clear, you know, and I think you just laid this out, I mean, line between that and Charlottesville. I mean, to some degree, I mean, this is what part of the message I think people wanted to get across by protesting Trump, you know, in the days immediately after the election, at the inauguration, as a sort of warning that, you know, he is unleashing these forces that can be very dangerous. And obviously we have to be continually vigilant. Certainly they were criminalized and arrested for that. But I think certainly, unfortunately, you know, it seems as if those warnings and those feelings by people like, hey, if we don't start standing up right now, this could get worse, to some degree appears to hold true now.
It does. I mean, you know, it's cold comfort, I'm sure, for some of the defendants, you know, being criminalized by the U.S. Attorney's Office, that some of the things that they warned against and that they, you know, were foresaw and were inspired to come out in the streets to resist have sort of come to pass. I mean, it's also important to recognize that this has been coming to pass for quite some time. You know, I mean, that there was a largely Black youth-led resistance to a Trump rally in Chicago last March, you know, on similar grounds. You know, this is something that people have been calling out pretty much since the moment Trump announced president in June of 2015. And that even at the time, folks were saying, you know, that Trump is engaging in a long tradition of white supremacy, that, you know, folks were recalling the memories of the Greensboro Massacre in 1979 when Nazis shot and murdered 5 anti-fascist protesters in Greensboro, North Carolina. I mean, this is a long-term struggle. And I think that, you know, even though the murder in Charlottesville and the Nazi attack in Charlottesville was a tragedy and a horror, we can really take heart that we saw an amazing coalition of forces come out and mobilize against Nazis on Saturday, August 12th in Charlottesville, and on Friday, August 11th as well. And, you know, there's an increasingly sort of diverse coalition of people who are willing to come out and call Nazis Nazis and are willing to come and speak out against fascism and not be cowed by the sort of moral equivalency that's being deployed rhetorically by folks like Fox News. And that, you know, they're willing to show up. And I think that, you know, fighting Nazis, resisting fascism should be common sense. And I think that most people in the United States think of it as common sense. You know, I mean, there's a reason that we have a tradition of popular culture of folks fighting Nazis, right? From Captain America to Indiana Jones to the new Marvel heroine America. And I'm excited to see that coalition grow and for folks to continue to stand up and join the forces that have been, you know, engaging in the struggle against white supremacy for decades and even centuries, and for that to, you know, take popular root.
No, I think that's definitely a very good point, and I think we're certainly seeing from this monument struggle certainly some new energy coming in a lot of different places. So I think it is quite interesting to see. I mean, I think that, you know, maybe there's sort of one other issue here that not one other, many other issues that I think is relevant, but that I think speaks to the importance to the powers that be, if you will, about the idea of the criminalization of protest and the idea that you would want 1.3 million names of basically trying to create a database of every single person that even thought about protesting is also an issue, I think, of how people perceive their own agency. I mean, I think that one of the, to me, things that almost certainly motivates these type of things against protests, this type of repression, and also, I think, to some degree, motivates the embrace by some elements at the highest levels of these far-right fascist forces is the idea that people may get in their heads that, like, oh, you don't have to wait for Congress or some politician to do something, but that, you know, movements in the street, movements of people can actually affect not only the political climate, but the things that actually happen. That sort of abstract idea is as important to quell for, I think, a lot of these people as anything else.
Yeah, I mean, there is real power in direct action. You know, I mean, I was incredibly inspired to see the video, I believe it was Monday night, of the crowd in Durham, North Carolina, you know, tear down the statue of a Confederate figure, right? And that we've actually now seen one of the young women who so courageously engaged in that direct action raided and arrested by police in North Carolina and charged with felony riot, actually charged with the same charge of the Inauguration Day protesters. And so, you know, I'm heartened that the Dream Host subpoena, that the news of 1.3 million people's IP addresses potentially being disclosed to the U.S. Attorney's Office in this, you know, state repression of political dissent and protest against the Trump regime is getting renewed attention and is really concerning to people. But that's also, you know, that's the tip of the iceberg, that you know, people finding information about protests and sort of how to engage in direct action is the least of the sort of actions that people are engaging in, right? And that we've seen people engage in direct action based on, you know, on principles of mutual aid and solidarity and anti-racism and anti-fascism, and do incredible work. You know, we saw street medics in Charlottesville function as first responders after this sort of horrific vehicle attack and do some truly heroic work. And that comes from a tradition of direct action. I think that, you know, we've seen Black Lives Matter and Antifa demonstrations and protests across the country, especially since Trump was elected, with, you know, really high levels of solidarity and mutual aid based direct action that's a different kind of politics than you know, relying on legislators or sort of state actors to do work for you. And you know, I come from a political tradition where I think both of those things are important, but I think that, you know, the criminalization of direct action and the increasing pattern of folks from Sacramento to Portland to Minneapolis to Standing Rock to Washington, D.C. to North Carolina being hit with these felony riot charges as a result of these direct actions is horrifying and should absolutely be called out as state repression against the movement to battle white supremacy.
No, I think that's a fantastic point as well. And I was in Charlottesville briefly in the aftermath, and it was interesting to see, like, well into the night, street medics continuing to just sort of move around the city, you know, I mean, just looking for folks, making sure things were okay, looking if people needed help. And obviously this at a time when, you know, there are rumors of active shooters and, you know, all sorts of snipers and all sorts of things like that. And I thought that was just a powerful statement that, you know, they were willing to sort of continue to be out there and make sure folks were safe and people who needed assistance got it, which I think was so big. And yeah, I think the felony riot piece is an important piece that you bring up there. I mean, first and foremost, I don't even know, like, what that, I mean, the way they're turning, like, you know, protest actions that are clearly nothing even in that ballpark, I think just in and of itself is concerning, because I really do feel like it's an attempt to create a redefinition on what protests really may be in so many different levels. And I think it's also, and I think it's also relevant to point out here, I mean, you look at the J20 defendants being put out by the U.S. Attorney's Office here in the District of Columbia, an office that has never been able to, or not been willing to, I've said publicly, and I'm happy to say it again, I think they're shielding these officers. A police officer in Washington, D.C. has never faced charges for a shooting and the shooting death in the line of duty. And I just think it's remarkable that they can, you know, drop felony riot charges on hundreds of people, you know, try to put people in jail for decades and decades and decades on the one hand, but then they seem totally willing to completely excuse the state violence against the Black community here in the District of Columbia on the other hand. It just seems to me very telling about their motives.
Yeah, I think it really is. And I think that it is actually incredibly important for us to understand this in the sort of context of ongoing struggles against police violence and criminalization of poor communities and communities of color in Washington, D.C. I mean, you know, last week, the U.S. Attorney, the same U.S. Attorney's Office that is prosecuting the folks for the Inauguration Day protests failed to even bring charges against Officer Brian Traynor, who murdered Terrence Sterling in September of last year, an unarmed Black man in Washington, D.C., at the corners of 3rd and M Streets Northwest. And, the MPD, as you mentioned, like no MPD officer has ever been brought up on criminal charges for the murder or brutality of mostly Black residents in D.C. And that, you know, those were the same officers that brutalized people on Inauguration Day. The riot statute that J20 defendants are being prosecuted under was actually the racist congressional response to the 1967 riots in Detroit, the uprisings in Detroit and Newark. Right. I mean, it's also the semantic slippage is really important here. Right. That, you know, the term riot has criminal consequences and that so often it's sort of a default for us. Or we'll talk about things like the Detroit riots, or the LA riots, when what they actually were uprisings against police brutality. Right. Then in all of these instances, these were popular uprisings by folks who were sick and tired of being treated with brutality by police officers and oftentimes against particular instances of police brutality. You know, so it's it's wild that this riot statute that is being used to criminalize, you know, people all across the country and especially in Washington, D.C. right now, is the result of a racist backlash against Black communities rising up against police brutality in 1967.
Yeah, I think it's a very good point that you raised there, too. And I think it also speaks to the importance of D.C. as the nation's capital, seeing these charges proliferate around the country. It's sort of like, you know, D.C., you know, known as a quote-unquote liberal city. If you can drop these kind of charges and push these kind of charges and try to isolate people here, you know, it emboldens the people elsewhere to feel like they can do it, especially because the U.S. Attorney's Office, you know, directly connected to the president here. It's not like there's a district attorney in D.C. because we don't have statehood. So it's almost like, to me, that the J20 defendant piece is sort of like the Trump administration saying, hey, like green light on this type of behavior, you know, just throw everything at the wall and let's see what sticks against, you know, progressive people who want to speak out on these issues.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I've talked to any number of defense attorneys who had never heard of prosecutions under a felony riot statute before this year. It is a dramatic escalation in state repression. It is an escalation of state repression that has its roots in, you know, a long, decades-long tradition of racist police brutality and criminalization of communities of color and you know, poor communities. And you know, it's incredibly important for us to understand that things like, you know, the prosecutions against the J20 defendants, things like the struggle in Charlottesville, are part of a long-term struggle against racism and state repression in the United States.
You know, we have about a minute here before we have to close. For those who have heard this, who want to find out more about how they can support those who are the J20 defendants who are being criminalized now, where should they go for more information?
Right now I feel like it's actually super important for folks to actually go to disruptj20.org, the site that is being subpoenaed. And so go to disruptj20.org/legal-fund, and you can donate to the efforts to support folks who are facing charges in D.C. and, you know, the folks whose prosecution is the source of this subpoena. And Yeah, I mean, I think that it's Defend J20 Resistance is another site. That DefendJ20Resistance.org is a site to go to for more information. They can go to DCLegalPosse.org to get more information about the organization that I'm a part of, the collective that I'm a part of. And yeah, I mean, Defend J20 Resistance is really the place to go and get more information about what's going on. So that's a place where the defendants and supporters from across the country have been doing active work.
Perfect. Perfect. Well, Sam, thank you so much. I really appreciate you being willing to join the show there. Hopefully people can check out those links. We are going to take a break. We're going to come back with more here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
And that was audio from the recently released documentary Whose Streets, which is what we will be talking about here in this segment. And we are very happy to be joined by Damon Davis, the co-director and producer of the film, and Chris Renteria, who is a co-producer. And today we are talking about a new, recently released documentary, one I'm quite excited about. I saw the trailer when I was going to see I Am Not Your Negro, Whose Streets? And we are joined by the team behind the documentary, Damon Davis, who is the co-director and producer, and Chris Renteria, who is the co-producer. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us here today on the show.
Thanks, Eugene.
Thank you.
So, Damon, I'll start with you here. Just give people who are listening a sense of what you guys are trying to do with the documentary, Whose Streets, what they can expect when they go to see it, and just a little bit of sort of maybe framing background of what you all have put on film here.
Okay. Well, in 2014, in Ferguson, Missouri, unarmed teenager named Michael Brown was gunned down by a police officer named Darren Wilson. So that is the catalyst for our film. And we watch, or the audience watches, a community of people come out in mourning. And we watch certain individuals in that community become, I guess, grow into lifelong activists. And so it's an intimate sort of look at what happened here in St. Louis and how these events affect people of color. And it just shows. We try to show the humanity and the complexity of human beings that are put into these extreme situations and how they react and how they survive under siege. But we're watching people grow. We're watching people grow.
Well, I think that's a great point, and I think it's one of the things I'll ask you this follow-up to, Damon, that I'm curious about, just sort of the effect on you as a filmmaker of or even choosing these subjects. I mean, I think so often we look at events that happen, you know, big events like this, and you sort of, you know, in some ways lose track of the fact that 9 times out of 10, most of the people see involved in the streets, involved in the organizing, are really just regular everyday people who, you know, just stepped up in a situation that was necessary.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened. I think I fall into that boat too. I'm from St. Louis, you know what I mean? It kind of came to me like it came to everyone else. And when I saw what people were doing, it inspired me to get out there and try to help in any way I could. And my goal was to capture, memorialize these people that had all this courage in the moment and just show And we really wanted to show a different side of this narrative that was perpetuated by the media. We really wanted to show what happened from the viewpoint of the community itself and the protesters and the organizers that were being, you know, just downright demonized in the media. So I hope we did a good job at that.
Well, I kind of feel like from what I already even saw in the trailer, I can say without any doubt that you did do a good job of that. And I'm sure that will be reflected in the response to the film. Chris, you know, I'm curious how it felt for you to sort of come to this project. I mean, I know you shot a lot of footage in the streets of Ferguson. I mean, did you ever imagine yourself being involved in a project like this, telling these stories? Or, I mean, I'm just curious about that as well.
No, originally I was doing a lot of music and doing a lot of things of that nature. And that's how I came to meet Damon and worked with him in the past. And so when this happened in our backyard, you know, everybody, was just contacting each other and just kind of coming together. And there's a saying that they have out here, which is get in where you fit in, you know. And when I saw what was happening, I was already working in media with film and photography. And I went out with my camera and just immediately got out in the street to try to tell a accurate story.
Well, I think certainly it's one of those things that it gets lost. And I think the point that you made there, Damon, about telling the story, you know, sort of the different side of the story is so crucial, because I think not only does the media tell the side of the story, you know, I think often in these situations wrong when they do it, but then they never really do that follow-up. They never really do the extra work to show the growth or the change or ongoing organizing or anything like that that's happening. And that to me is, and maybe in some ways, the most important part of the story is that, like, these things often aren't one-off events.
Exactly. And there's no context to that one flashpoint. There had to be something before, and you know what I mean? Like, there's time before that leads to these events. No one ever tries to analyze that. They never analyze the aftermath of people. There's no context around why people feel a certain way. It's usually just journalism based on sensationalism. And that was one thing that Sabah and I were very adamant about not replicating. We wanted to show the beauty and the mundane and the strength and people's resilience and their fight. And I don't think that the media cycle even has the bandwidth to do something like that. And I don't think people have an actual hunger for that. They just want the flashbang explosion, you know, the surface level stuff. So what we want to do is go deeper into these people's lives and deeper into my community. And so you could just see what these people are made of. And so maybe you could see your own humanity by looking at theirs, hopefully.
Well, you know, one other question I'm always curious about, Damon, and you're from St. Louis, so I've asked a couple people this on this show before. I mean, you know, and especially reflecting here now just shortly after the third anniversary of Mike Brown's death, I mean, were you at all surprised to see Ferguson become this national epicenter of all play? I mean, I think for many of us who were outside of the area, it was just sort of like, where is this place? What is going on here? Oh my God, I can't believe this is happening to some degree. At least some people were saying that. I mean, were you surprised to see this become this flashpoint for the whole nation? Or was it something that perhaps, you know, it was just one incident away, you know, the whole time in some ways, given the circumstances there in the St. Louis area?
Right, that's kind of a two-pronged question. I know from just growing up here, the culture of racism is a very out front one. It's not as you know, polite and political as it is in larger cities that I've seen. I think we kind of in a time capsule sort of situation where it's an untouched sort of bastion here. So the events around it and the things that led up to it do not surprise me. But what did surprise me is how quickly the story, I guess, rippled out into the world. And Sabah and I talk about this often, but that was social media. The reason I met her, she was from New York. They came down. The only reason these other people were aware of this struggle that was going on here was because of social media. And the only reason that people could connect with each other, like across cities, across countries, with similar experiences, was because the internet was in play. And that's never been like that in history. You know what I mean? And it was also going on all over the world. When you look at China, when you look at Egypt, all of these situations were happening at the same time as Ferguson. And the internet was a major tool for organizing and spreading the word to people that could relate and people that wanted to help. So I think that was surprising to me, like being this close to it. And then when you hear people from other places and then you go online and you see it's on these huge media outlets and you see how fast it was out there. You know what I'm saying? How fast it rippled out. That was definitely surprising to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think that's a good point. I mean, it was being, you know, halfway across country in Washington, D.C. when it was going down. I mean, it was almost like via social media, this new tool that you had, it was almost like primetime television. You know, I mean, you could watch so significantly and you know, shout out to all the brave independent journalists and activists who were, you know, doing everything they could to keep all of us around the country as appraised as possible to what was going on. I mean, it almost seemed like in another way, the other sort of piece of it, too, to me, about the social media and what I sort of compelled me to keep watching this, Damon, as well. It had almost like a, you know, you can't hide this, you can't keep us quiet sort of feel. And like, y'all brought all these tanks and cops and everything out here, but you still can't isolate this struggle and isolate us from people who want to support us. And I thought that was an extraordinarily powerful piece of it as well.
Yes, exactly. I definitely agree with that. And by the grace of God, that tool was here. And I think that's also a point of contention kind of with the older generation, just the fact that organizing looks different because you got a screen and a cell phone now instead of pamphlets and flyers. But I think that it was a major tool for us so the people could just relate, and then they came to help. You know what I'm saying? It was like an SOS.
Well, you know, Chris, I'll start with you with this next question, but I'm curious both of your thoughts on this. I mean, the film coming out so closely to what we saw in Charlottesville over this weekend, does it give any sort of any new feeling to you of the importance of what you did? I mean, I think I don't know. To me, it seems very poignant when people are having a lot of these conversations about white supremacy and so on and so forth, to return to this moment of Ferguson, which I think woke up the country in a new way. Not that we've never dealt with this before, but certainly in a new way, to the permanence or the continued permanence of so many of these issues of racism and so on.
It's really shocking and hard to swallow at times. You know, watching this over the weekend as we premiered on Friday, it was just how timely it has become once again, unfortunately. But you know, I would just say that, you know, Damon and Sabah have done an incredible job of holding up a mirror and showing people who have been organizing the humanity inside themselves and the love that comes out of these movements, born out of love and change. And so my hope is that people will actually take this in and see this movie and really rekindle that fire inside themselves at a time when it's needed more than ever.
For sure. Damon, your thoughts on this?
I think what our film is going to show and what was caught on camera by, the media that was down there in Charlottesville is what you're going to see is the contrast between the way black people are dealt with and the way white people are dealt with by the powers that be. I think that's the biggest thing, the state and how the state deals with these things and what the state allows and how the leaders talk about certain groups of people and how certain force is required for one set of people with one agenda and how force is used with another set of people with another agenda. And I think I fall back on what Chris said about a mirror, but a different kind of mirror. Now let's look at the mirror, not of the organizer and the protester, but let's look at the mirror of how the systemic differences in the way that black people and white people are policed and the level of tolerance for different types of behaviors. I think that is what's going to come across clearly if people watch our film and then they go back and they rewatch the events of what happened at Charlottesville. You know, I think that's the mirror. It's going to show you just what America is, like what America's always been. And people just like this denial that people have. I think if we would just get off of that, we could actually make some kind of traction. But because we have such a short attention span and we have like selective amnesia about our history here, I think that's why we keep falling back into these same holes, you know?
No, I think that's a great point. I mean, and I think it speaks to the point that you're making as well, too, about the importance of seeing this film in the wake of Charlottesville, because, you know, one of the big hashtags was the "This is not us." And when I saw that, I said, like, you know, I get it, the sentiment. Sure, I feel you. I hear you. You're looking to separate yourself from a guy, this terrorist who've killed this woman and injured so many people. But unfortunately, like, this is us. Like, racist, terrorist violence is as American as apple pie in so many different ways. And I think quite frankly, Damon, that was one of the things that shocked so many people in Ferguson who were not black, especially, was the fact that the police even have these kind of military capabilities to that degree. I mean, everyone knows about SWAT teams, but I think that was to some people like, whoa, I didn't even know this was out there. But obviously, it's been used for some time in many different ways, and that just is such an important thing to remember as well.
Yeah, definitely.
And I should say here, too, I realize I've totally buried the lead for our listeners here on 105.5 FM in Washington, D.C., but the film Whose Streets is showing now at Landmark's E Street Cinema. That's the E Street Cinema downtown, if you want to check it out. And I'm curious, Damon, so far, what you felt about how the movie has been received. I mean, I've seen, you know, quite a few since you guys premiered on Friday, you know, really positive nods in towards the film and people excited to go see it. Have you been feeling so far? It's only been a few days of what you've seen in reactions.
It is very hard to describe in words. I would say that. But the proudest moment for me is the premiere here at home and seeing the people that I was in the streets with there, and like people that are actually in the movie, and the pride that they had watching it for the first time. So that's the biggest. I guess the biggest nod we can get, in my opinion, and I think my homegirl Sabathia is the same way. But the people that lived it like it and respect it, and that's what means the most to me, quite frankly.
No, I think that's a very good point, and I think certainly to some degree that was from what you've been saying here, the whole reason why you guys made this movie was to lift up folks' voices and really show their struggle. I mean, how it seems to me, Damon, I'm curious how you think about this, and I think this is, I'm sure, probably carried out in the film itself, and I think this is very relevant. And my sort of following of St. Louis, the little bit I have been able to since Ferguson, even though it hasn't been covered as much, I mean, it really does seem like this ecosystem that arose out of Ferguson has strengthened itself, has become stronger, and that there's like a whole new sort of energy now to push forward on a number of issues. And I think that is a really important statement to make, is that even if you don't hear about it, it's not as if people haven't grown stronger.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree with that. I think people, that's the most positive thing I've seen arise out of all of this, is basically people divesting from this system and starting a lot of real grassroots, like organizing, like people trying to feed kids and teach kids and even people, like really young people, just being radicalized on a level that I have never seen personally. Everybody from A lot of people from my generation are just very much awake and trying to just are paying attention. They, like, people are not asleep at the wheel, so to speak. Watching a lot of young people take office in Missouri and in the city, and just like people just trying to take control of their own lives and not waiting for some system that was not built for them in the first place to acknowledge them and show them any kind of love and respect, but trying to find other ways to survive and to accommodate the needs that system has never met for them, you know?
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. And I'm also curious if you connect this doing this documentary a little bit to the rise, I think, in this independent journalism we've seen at these protests, at these uprisings, of people wanting to tell their own story, sort of like recognizing from Jump Street that the story isn't going to be told for us, and we have to tell it ourselves, whether it be at the point of attack, obviously in terms of covering things from a journalistic perspective, but also on the back end in terms of the narratives we draw about how these events happen, play out, and then what comes in the aftermath.
Well, I don't know if we are the beginning of that wave or what, but I know that definitely one of the main reasons Sabah and I connected was that we were not seeing the truth on TV. That's what brought her from New York. That's what she told me. And that's one of the main reasons I wanted to do a documentary, because I would be out somewhere seeing the event happen and it wasn't, and then when I would see it told back to me, it was not an accurate portrayal of the events. And so I think it's kind of a web of things when we're talking like that, because it's kind of, or chicken before the egg or whatever, because there are people out here, citizen journalists, letting everybody know. And so they're telling their story. But the one thing that's different, and what I'm really humbled by and grateful that Sabai and I got to do and our team got to do, was we are putting the narrative out at the scale of the other media outlets, right? So if you're not tuned into somebody, if you don't know that person, if you don't follow them on some social media, if you don't happen to catch it on YouTube, the likelihood of you seeing that version of the story is very low. But with this film, I think we could give a platform to that viewpoint that a lot of us citizen journalists do not usually get. And that's something that I'm very excited about and very grateful for. But that I know there's a lot of people that inspired me to say, well, like, I want to get out here and tell this story. Primarily because, like, the power that the media outlets have is so overpowering that you don't ever get to see that other narrative. So I hope that we got to put this stuff up on a platform on a level that it doesn't usually get seen, if that makes sense.
No, it makes perfect sense. And I think that is absolutely the case. And I'm very much looking forward to seeing the big cultural impact I think this is going to have. And I really appreciate you guys joining the show here. Again, Whose Streets, that is a documentary. You can go to whosestreets.com to learn more. There's showtimes on there. There's also everything you need to go see it. And again, if you're listening here in the D.C. area on 105.5 FM. You can go to the Landmark Theater down there on E Street downtown and check it out. You could even go tonight if you want. I would highly encourage that. And that is going to do it for us here today. And we are going to leave you the same way we came, with some audio from the new documentary, Whose Streets, which is playing in theaters all across the nation.
This is chemical warfare that you are not supposed to be able to use on U.S. soil.
This movement was born in love, and love always wins.
We are raising activists. If there's going to be any change, it starts with our children.